Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
I'll be happy when the lilacs bloom again. God is monotonous to men. Only way to keep affection fresh. Get some mess for your flesh. I'll be happy when the lilacs bloom again. Ain't no need to blow no sirens then.
When the nylons bloom again. That's from the Fats Waller musical, Ain't Misbehaving. One of the, I guess, ironies of the 1940s was that nylon was introduced, but then it was used for the war effort, and people apparently wanted their stockings back with that terrific new product, that terrific new material, nylon, one of many, many, many plastic things that we have come to take for granted, that have come to inhabit our world, and have come to take up root inside us in many cases. We're going to be talking about plastics today. We're going to begin with Susan Frankel, author of Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Her Substack is 1,017 Acres, Life in the Park. Susan Frankel, welcome to our conversation.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Before we even maybe talk a little bit about that 1940s giddiness about the arrival of plastics, welcomed with open arms by pretty much everybody. You have a nice example of kind of a demarcation, and that is the Titanic, which sank to the bottom of the ocean it was 112 years ago. Is that right? Yeah, I think 112 years ago. So explain why that might be an interesting thing to look at in terms of plastics.
Well, I came across a report from one of the people who did a salvage operation on the Titanic, and the guy said one of the things that struck him in looking at the objects that they found on the ship, you know, that included jewelry and china and so forth. He said there was not a single plastic item there, which is striking. I mean, you know, truthfully, it's sort of not that surprising. There wasn't a lot of plastic in people's lives then, and what was there might have dissolved in salt water anyway, but it is a kind of striking image to think of this thing that had nothing plastic in it.
Right. I mean, when you contrast it to our lives today, from the moment we get up, go sit down in the toilet or pick up our toothbrush or whatever, we're just in contact with plastics all day long. But I think another interesting point that you make is that the initial stirrings of plastic were in many cases a response to the depletion of certain kinds of natural resources, which I think, you know, we'd be sort of in favor of that. I'm sitting here in Hartford about 30 miles north of a community called Ivoryton. One of the reasons there was an interest in developing some kind of new material was that ivory was being used for piano keys and billiard balls and stuff like that, and there just weren't enough elephants. Set aside whether it's a nice thing to do to shoot elephants for their ivory, there wasn't enough of it. Say a little more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the very first big commercial plastic celluloid was actually developed because a billiard ball maker was looking for an alternative for the ivory used in billiard balls, because there was concern that elephants were being hunted into extinction. And actually, you know, celluloid, the early celluloid ads kind of featured this idea that they were a salvation, that celluloid was sort of a savior of natural materials, you know, things like tortoise shell or ivory or coral that were being depleted. So, you know, that idea kind of motivated the invention of early plastics. Bakelite, which, you know, we kind of know from jewelry, which was the first really synthetic plastic, that was created because there was a demand for insulation for wire, and the country was in the process of electrifying, and there wasn't enough of the material that was then used for insulation, which was shellac. And I didn't know this before I did research for the book, but shellac, it turns out, comes from the lac beetle. And, you know, it takes something like 6,000 beetles to make a pound of shellac. So you weren't going to, you know, wire up a whole country on that. you know, ironically, those were that impetus, that sense of scarcity was the impetus for the first early plastics. Once you started to get plastics coming out of the petrochemical industries in the 20s and 30s, those plastics weren't created out of a desire to fulfill a need. It was more like, hey, we're going to create the material and then we'll invent the need. And that really flipped the script on plastics.
Yeah, I mean, for the petrochemicals, a lot of times it was some kind of sludge or residue or precipitate at the end of some kind of refining process. Like, what do we do with this gunk that's sitting down there at the bottom of the vat?
Exactly. Exactly. What do we do with this gunk? Oh, look, we've got something cool and interesting. We're not quite sure what it could be good for, but we can make a lot of it and figure it out. So, you know, the classic story of that is polyethylene, which literally was created through a lab accident, and no one really knew what to do with it. And then it was created in 1933. And then when World War II came along, people sort of realized it had this amazing ability to shield radio and electrical frequencies. And they used that to build radar that was light enough to put on planes that proved to be a really critical advantage during World War II. At the end of the war, then you have this material that is kind of interesting, and people, companies have been making a lot of it. Now they need to figure out what to do with it. And that then became, you know, the foundation for packaging, and polyethylene is, you know, the king of packaging, produced by the bazillions, and a lot of the reason why we are upset about, you know, plastics' impact on the environment.
Right, and so I mean, World War II also created a demand for scalability. I mean, suddenly you needed to give toothbrushes to a lot of soldiers and sailors. So once again, the fact that you didn't have to use lac beetles to produce that you could, in fact, make a lot of something in a hurry, probably helped with the ramping up of the plastic industry.
Absolutely. I tell the story in my book about combs, which had been made from rubber. And when the war came along, rubber was needed for the war, but they still had to distribute combs to all these GIs. And so they turned to one of the sort of early plastics companies to make combs. And I remember seeing, you know, an ad showing, I think it was either Dow or DuPont, showing how they had, like, you know, were able to produce tens of thousands of combs. And they had this out of a big pile of combs that they had been able to turn out in an hour next to the combs that were made from celluloid or rubber, you know, like this little paltry pile. So yeah, that scalability became huge during the war.
And, you know, in the post-war era, there was still an awful lot of promise, a lot of excitement, a sense that this was where the future was headed. I think it's summed up beautifully, and I apologize for playing this clip. I'm sure you don't get to get through any interviews without somebody playing this clip. But yes, 1967, The Graduate. Dustin Hoffman plays Benjamin Braddock. He's wondering what to do with his life. He gets some advice from a guest at his parents' pool party. This is A1 Cat.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
Enough said. That's a deal.
So plastics, as a metaphor, is kind of plastic or elastic anyway. It changes over time in the 1940s and 1950s. It's the future. Everything's going to be great. We've got this magical material that's actually a lot of different kinds of materials. And by the 1960s, there's something a little bit empty about that exchange, as written by Buck Henry. He's probably already sensing that there's a bill to be paid for all this, or that some of this is just kind of written in invisible ink. And obviously, as we move forward, we're more and more distrustful of this. Plastic comes to be a symbol of what? Of kind of a thoughtless consumerism?
It comes to be a symbol of a lot of things. I mean, it comes to be a symbol of thoughtless consumerism. It comes to be a symbol of kind of phoniness, which I think is how it was used in The Graduate, of a kind of artificiality, of emptiness, you know, vapidness. cheapness, partly because a lot of plastic got used for imitation materials. So what seemed really cool in, you know, 1905, when you could make something look like tortoiseshell out of celluloid, by 1970, doesn't look so cool anymore. And we were starting to get the early intimations of problems with plastic. I mean, that's late 60s, early 70s is when you start to see the first reports about plastic being, you know, out in the ocean. You get the first reports of chemicals from plastics leaching into people's bodies. So people started to realize this stuff that we had all around us maybe wasn't so great for us.
On the other hand, to quote from another movie, we just can't quit you. We can't quit plastic. I mean, the advantages of plastic seem to outweigh the early whispers, or to drown out the early whispers of caution. And the more that we knew about plastics, the more somehow addicted we also were to them.
Well, we became addicted. I mean, there's stuff about plastic that's great, you know. I mean, it's convenient, it's clean, it's cheap. We can make, you know, pretty much at this point, pretty much whatever we want. We figured out how to make out of plastic. And so it does amazing things, whether that's, you know, a bulletproof vest or, you know, a tether for an astronaut doing a spacewalk, or, you know, an artificial hip, or, you know, my lightweight eyeglasses. You know, and we like that stuff. I will also say that, you know, the industry, the petrochemical industry, has been very good at convincing us that that we need some of these things, convincing us that we need a plastic bag to take our groceries from, you know, the checkout counter to our house, or that we need little plastic stirrers to stick in the top of our coffee cup so that it doesn't get cold. I mean, there's sort of these invented conveniences that we come to like, but that have been sort of foisted upon us so that our sense of what our options are become kind of limited. So I think there's responsibility all the way around. I don't think it's just us becoming addicted. I think that there are enablers in that addiction, if you will.
Yes, indeed. And it is hard. I mean, today is Monday. That's when my milk comes. I don't have a milkman. I have a milk person, but I have my milk delivered in a glass bottle. And with it comes butter that's just kind of wrapped in paper. It might be a little bit treated, but it's just like a piece of paper around the butter. And they also bring eggs in a cardboard carton, but they also bring cheese, and that's all wrapped in plastic. But I mean, you could do little things like that, but you know, from the time you get up in the morning, and as we were saying, you sit down on the toilet seat, well, that's plastic. Your toothbrush is plastic. Could be your sink's plastic too. We've got some kind of weird sort of wood simulation plastic stuff on the floor of our bathroom. You haven't even started your day and you've got a lot of plastic all around you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there are some things, I mean, I remember in my book, I interviewed this woman who had tried very hard to purge plastic from her life because she saw this photograph of one of the Laysan albatross out in Midway Island, where there's just, you know, that's sort of the one of the centers of the Great Garbage Patch. And that had really revolted her to see it stuffed with plastic. And she had decided to try to purge as much plastic from her life as possible. And I remember her lamenting the one thing that she couldn't get around was cheese. Like, you know, she loved cheese, and she could get almost no cheese that was wrapped in plastic, that wasn't wrapped in plastic. And that was really sad for her. So yeah, it's very hard to escape. And I don't, you know, and in some cases we don't necessarily want to. I mean, I was grateful for what all the sort of plastic single use stuff that got us through the pandemic. You know, I am grateful for my lightweight eyeglasses. I'm grateful for, you know, my computer, which has a lot of plastic in it. So it's a tough thing to escape. And I think, you just sort of want to think mindfully about it. I think the one thing we could do less of is single-use plastics.
Yeah. I mean, you know, even the takeout stuff. I mean, what you're doing is you're usually asking your restaurant provider to dump hot food into some kind of plastic or container, which is, I mean, the heat is going to actually cause faster leakage. It's probably not even a great thing. But I agree about, you know, getting us through COVID. And it's certainly the case that nobody has ever said to their doctor, oh, by the way, please don't use anything plastic in treating me. I mean, medicine would grind to a halt right now without plastic, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That said, you know, hospitals are trying to figure out ways to use safer plastics. I mean, the vinyl that's used in hospitals, vinyl is a crappy material and it's a dangerous material. So green hospitals are trying to get rid of vinyl and find substitutes. Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I think there has to be some pressure on the chemical companies to, I mean, we're not going to get rid of plastic and we're not going to do without plastic. We can cut down on our use of plastic. We can try to get our milk in glass bottles and stuff like that. But sooner or later, also, the chemical companies are going to have to create materials that are equally functional, but non-toxic and more biodegradable. And I mean, I think that's probably within their capacities. They just haven't done it yet because it's cheaper to do otherwise. And another thing they do, we'll be talking about this, I think, a little bit more in the second section, is if you start getting worried, like BPA or something like that, if people identify one particular chemical or plasticizer that they, you know, they're worried about, they've been told they should be worried about it, the companies just, they develop a slightly different plastic that doesn't have that name, isn't quite the same chemical compound. So when Consumer Reports, you know, starts testing stuff, they won't find that thing anymore. It's just whack-a-mole, really.
Absolutely. It is whack-a-mole. I mean, I think, you know, we need better chemical legislation that, you know, there's something like 10,000 chemicals that have been grandfathered in through the existing laws. And that, you know, many of which seem to have some sort of health impact. You mentioned earlier, I mean, the first plastics were kind of made out of sludge and kind of byproducts of chemical refining and oil processing. That's not really the case anymore. There's a whole industry now that goes into making plastics. You know, we need to go back to figure out, are there other kinds of waste products we can use to make plastic out of that would make it easier to recycle, that would make it safer, that would, be better for us and the planet, which I think is eminently doable. But, we've got to press for that.
Yeah, and I think we're beginning to wrap up here, Susan. This is fascinating stuff. But I think another point that you've made is that we could kind of also use plastic as a parable for future, that might teach us about future decisions we're going to make about something like, oh, I don't know, AI. What could go wrong is a really good question to ask. But I don't know if there's more you want to say about this, about how the lessons of plastic might be applied to other innovations.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, this is sort of the classic story of human technology, where we're sort of smarter in some ways and not so smart in others. I mean, I think, you know, the fact that we created these materials is a testimony to human ingenuity and creativity. There, many of them are amazing, but we just have to be smarter about how we produce them and make them, and force ourselves to think about the long-term consequences of the things we make. It's the exact same dilemma we're dealing with now on AI, or that we're dealing with around atomic energy. I mean, it is the question that keeps confronting us in technology. Our technological prowess and ingenuity needs to keep pace with our sort of ethical sensibilities and our ability to think long-term.
Yeah, AI and nuclear technology, two other things that are not on the Titanic. Maybe the whole idea, we should just go live on the Titanic. It's very safe down there. But you're going to need some plastic to get down there. Susan Frankel, author of Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. Her Substack is 1017 Acres, Life in the Park. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Colin.
And we'll take a little break right now. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about this, particularly about what it looks like when it turns up out in the ocean. You heard about that garbage patch, I think.
Cellophane, 'cause you can look right through me, walk right by me, and never know I'm there. I tell ya, cellophane, Mr. Cellophane, should have been my name.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to Hartford for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
I think you get the drift. And speaking of the drift, plastic is drifting around in our oceans right now. We're going to talk about that and other things with our next guest, Erica Serino, communications manager of the Plastic Pollution Coalition and the author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. Erica Serino, welcome to our show.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for having me.
You might have heard our previous guest, Susan, mention the albatross. I know this is something that you have some up close and personal thoughts about. You've been out to visit the so-called Pacific garbage patch. Maybe talk about that and about the albatross.
Sure. So in 2016, I was invited as a photojournalist to venture into the Great Pacific Garbage Patch with a group of Danish sailors and scientists. So they were with a nonprofit organization called Plastic Change. And we were also accompanied by Chris Jordan, who is a photographer who took many of those photos that I think many people associate with plastic pollution's impact on the ocean of these albatrosses just stuffed with plastic. And so we headed out into the patch at the time. You know, again, being a member of the media myself, I, you know, kind of saw it discussed as an emblem of humanity's wastefulness. You know, it was described as a floating island of garbage, twice the size of Texas, just like in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, far from people, far from civilization. And as someone who grew up in a coastal area, I've witnessed plastic pollution piling up both on land and in the marine environment, right on Long Island Sound. And I really felt like something might have been missing from that story. So, of course, I had to jump on that boat and head out there.
Anything in particular that you found that was missing from that story that you want us to know now?
I'll say that plastic pollution incorporates much more than just plastic itself. And plastic pollutes from the moment its fossil fuel ingredients are extracted from the earth, all the way through refining, transportation, storage of those fossil fuels, through plastic production, its transportation, use, and disposal. Plastic is everlasting and only breaks up. It does not break down benignly like natural materials around us.
Yeah, and there's just this incredible chain of it in our lives, you know? I mean, there's plastic trash that in landfills, getting chemicals into our water, into our soil. There's incineration of trash that gets it into the air. We've got animals who are eating feeds, plants that may be contaminated with plasticizers. We got plastic mulch. We've got, I mean, it just right. sort of goes on and on all the way through to the end and then starts over again. It does seem as though these days there's a little bit more awareness of the fact that this stuff is turning up in our bodies. It wasn't enough to show the ocean or the albatross. People tend to get more worried about things when it's inside people. And we're starting to hear terms like microplastics and nanoplastics. Can you help us understand those two terms in particular?
Sure. So again, as I mentioned, plastic is not breaking down, it's breaking up. So imagine, you know, it's just breaking apart. I use the analogy in my book of Lego bricks, because it is a plastic item that I think many of us are familiar with. So imagine these, you know, particles of plastic just getting smaller and smaller. You pull them apart. So when they are exposed to wind, waves, sunlight, different time, like extreme temperatures and microorganisms in the ocean, this happens very rapidly. But in reality, it's happening all around us all the time. There are these small plastic particles, you know, microplastics being the slightly larger size range and nanoplastics being the very nanoscale, microscopic, can't see with the naked eye type of plastics. They're in our air, they're in fresh and salt waters, they're in soils, virtually in all of our foods, including, you know, unwrapped produce at our grocery stores and from markets, you know, tap water, bottled water, you know, it goes on and on and on. And I think we're kind of just waking up to the fact that this material is now a part of us. I've learned recently, you know, there were plastic particles found in 62 out of 62 placentas sampled in a recent study, and they've been found in our hearts, our bloodstreams, our veins, our lungs, feces, testes and semen, breast milk, and brains. So this is, you know, the tip of the iceberg here. I could think we could pretty much assume at this point they're all throughout our bodies.
Yeah, and it's not just one thing, too. We talk about plastics as though it were one thing, but one study from a group of researchers in Norway and Switzerland identified more than 16,000 chemicals in plastic products. We're not really talking about one thing. We're talking about a whole bunch of things. And on top of that, once again, because of just the scalability of studying this, researchers really don't know what the pathology is, right? They don't really, they might know that certain plastics are endocrine disruptors or something, but overall, we don't know what it means that all of that stuff is inside us.
I think we can, we don't know the specifics yet, but we are finding more and more evidence of harm. For example, recently another study showed that patients undergoing treatment for heart disease who had microplastics in the plaques of their carotid arteries also showed signs of inflammation in their bodies, and they were very likely to go on to experience heart attack, stroke, and death from any cause compared to patients who did not have microplastics, evidence of microplastics traveling to their hearts. And of those chemicals mentioned that you mentioned in that study, at least 4,200 of them are considered highly hazardous to human health and the environment. And I like to tell people, you know, we humans, we are actually a part of nature. We're not separate from it. We really know that plastic and these chemicals are not compatible with those albatrosses, with, you know, microorganisms in nature, and many others, and they're definitely not compatible with us.
Yeah, and I think also how airborne they are. There was a 2019 study that suggested that people could inhale up to 272 pieces of microplastic in a 24-hour period. I think we tend to think about this stuff as, well, maybe I should be more careful about drinking water out of plastic bottles or, you know, eating stuff out of plastic containers. But it's not as simple as that. I mean, air has plastic in it. You're not going to be able to get away from this stuff.
Exactly. I actually was up close in the lab with the scientists who did that study, and they had a breathing mannequin made out of metal with two mechanical lungs. And it was horrifying to realize that, you know, even in a spare Danish college student's apartment, you know, plastic particles are pretty much everywhere. And we think about it, as you mentioned earlier, you know, you're in your bathroom and, you know, plastic toilet seat, plastic toothbrush, but also the paint on your walls, the finish on your floor, your furniture, many fabrics are made out of plastic today. So it really is all around us at all times. And so because it's not going away, it's only kind of breaking up into these pieces. That's how it's getting into us, really. We're eating, breathing, and drinking it in.
So we could try to limit that a little bit. And I know that you experimented with the idea of a plastic-free house circa 2020.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, after I wrote my book, Thicker Than Water, and joined Plastic Pollution Coalition as the communications manager, I really, you know, have been pushing my house to be plastic free. And I had built it with that premise starting in 2020 and built it mostly from wood, metal. The exterior is pine siding painted with pine tar and linseed oil. The floors are wood. The finishes, as I said, could be metal. Stone is another one I've used. I couldn't get away from it entirely in the sense that building during a global pandemic, the price of everything went up exponentially. So it's not a plastic-free house, but it's a very low plastic house. And my boyfriend and I, we live very simply. I try to really, you know, live the example. And, you know, we don't have a lot of money either. It's not like I go out and buy all these plastic-free gizmos that promise you to have a zero-waste life. I just make simple choices, you know, like saving glass jars, using that for my leftover food, for example, having my few reusable cups and taking them with me on the go when I need them, and, you know, just being conscious of what I bring into our lives. That's what I encourage all around.
Yeah, and that's a great thing to do. I will say with some pride, I'm holding the water bottle that I bring to work most days, which is one of those
very
ones.
Nice.
That it's glass, but then it's got kind of rubber around it, that kind of mesh rubber. I don't know that I've really solved the problem here, but at least the water is encased in glass. It's hard to do. And the other part of it is you and your boyfriend can do this, but if you're surrounded by other people who are not doing it, chances are you're going to be running into just tremendous amounts of it in the air and water.
Totally. And that's why I really do stress. And, you know, my current job now, I'm kind of on the other side of the journalist table. And I speak to people in the media about this issue like you. And I really, you know, emphasize that we need these principles. So these values fundamentally: reuse, refill, repair, share, regenerate, and refuse single use. I mean, really, single use anything is wasteful. It's much better to choose, you know, mycelium packaging made out of mushrooms that breaks down, or algae-based packaging, again, that won't, you know, introduce these thousands and thousands of chemicals into our bodies and environment. But, you know, plastic was only mass produced, as we learned, you know, really in the 1940s and 50s following World War II. So we had solutions before. I was really excited to hear that you had a milk service delivered, dairy service delivered to your house. But to engage in that radical change, we really need to happen on a systems level. And that means advocating for policies to change. We need businesses to change their practices. And I think I feel really fortunate to be part of Plastic Pollution Coalition because we have business members showing that reuse and refill is a really viable alternative. It can make business sense, you know? And so to see this happening right before our eyes, we have the solutions that we need today. We don't need to wait for these bad industries, because they, you know, have caused so much death and destruction, especially on the front lines. I myself lived in a frontline community next to a trash incinerator and Asheville for the first 6 years of my life. So I've experienced environmental injustice firsthand, and it's mostly low income, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities that are facing these issues. So there's a huge injustice aspect to this as well that I like to point out. But in order to fix these problems, we need to really scale up the solutions that we need, these simple things, really waste less. And that's the premise of all of this.
Yeah. And I think also the more educated people get about this, the more outraged they become about it, the more likely systemic change is. I'm actually holding right here. I realize I shouldn't be holding a hard copy of this magazine. I should be reading it online, but it is Consumer Reports in February of 2024. This is their cover story was about how much plastic is in our foods. And they had a lot of great stuff in it. I don't know how motivated it's going to make people, but even little stuff like, okay, I'll confess that when I go to buy pet food, and I'm sure pet food is a really complicated topic in this regard anyway, but I also use a lot of coupons, and then I'm very excited about how much money I've saved, so I get the receipt and I've just discovered I really shouldn't be doing that. Even the receipt that's coming out of the cash register, right? Tell us about that.
Oh, my boyfriend warns everyone at checkout counters, and he's listening right now probably laughing, but yeah, it's coated with toxic BPA, and so it's absorbed right through your skin into your bloodstream. There have been studies showing that the transfer happens immediately. So even that kind of wastefulness, you know, if you can get an e-receipt, that's a great workaround, or just say no receipt at all, please. But again, we're in this like kind of culture that is just so wasteful. And we've kind of come to accept that, like, you sit down in a restaurant and reflexively the server hands you a disposable straw. And luckily, more likely than not today, depending on where you live, maybe that straw will be made out of paper or another material, but that's still a wasteful item that doesn't need to be created, that doesn't need to add to the waste and injustice that's building up on our planet. And so if we can really implement, you know, again, these values in our fundamental systems of our society, that's the solution we need. I would point out too, right now, we have the UN Plastics Treaty on the table, and next month negotiators are gathering in Ottawa, Canada. So this fourth out of five sessions, is really crucial because we are getting near the end of this process. And we need our leaders, our world leaders, to really understand that this issue is not going to go away with, you know, pushing it down the pipe, promising recycling, which is an industry narrative that has never proven effective. In fact, it only perpetuates pollution and injustice. So we need to get everyone on board. Public awareness is great. And again, like you mentioned too, it's great that you can take steps in your own life to reduce your exposure, but it needs to be a global level change.
Right. But I mean, there is kind of a way in which this can pyramid upwards. I mean, can reverse pyramid from small things if a lot of people do them. And I do think just examining your own life, which I've started to do as a result of working on this particular episode, and it is conversations that you can have. So I'll give you two things and you can comment on them. Well, so this one works in my favor. I'm a big believer in wooden cutting boards. My partner does not like wooden cutting boards. She doesn't like anything she can't put in the dishwasher. She would put the our dog in the dishwasher if the dog would fit. But I mean, I've read stuff about how using a plastic cutting board is like eating 10 credit cards a year or something. I mean, this, you know, you're really cutting the stuff that you're putting into your body onto plastic and making kind of divots in the plastic as you're doing it. It doesn't take a scientist to figure out this is probably kind of risky.
Oh, totally. I mean, any exposure to plastic is a risk, basically. And, you know, take your risk carefully. I mean, like I said, I mean, I'm not perfect. And I never shame anyone for using plastic. But on that, you know, personal choice level, it's like, well, you can choose to avoid, you know, some plastics, maybe some at this point, you know, you'll avoid later down the line. But definitely things like cutting boards, anything that you're kind of physically altering or heating, for example, that's something you really should avoid with plastic, putting it in your microwave, even putting in the refrigerator and exposing it to cold temperatures can release microplastics at a higher rate. So just, you know, educating yourself and realizing, you know, there is information out there. I definitely point a lot of people to our website, plasticpollutioncoalition.org. We are there to give you the facts. We have lots of studies and resources on our site. And information for communities, how to actually get, you know, resources to make that change happen. So we want to encourage people to feel excited about change and not worried. I mean, this issue is so heavy. I often speak to children about it and it's not easy. It's, you know, something I have to be honest about because, you know, I think that's really important, but we can't be paralyzed by the information that's coming at us today. I think we have to all work together to make this change happen.
Right. So I just want to do one more kind of household example, just because I don't want to come across as overly self-congratulatory. I want to do one where I'm wrong. So my partner dislikes fragrances in things, like in soaps and cleaners and stuff like that. And I like soap that smells like peppermint and stuff. But getting ready for this show, I just discovered that phthalates, which is one of the real major, you know, villains in this whole plastic conversation, are often used to impart or make fragrances anyway. I guess there's sort of a breakdown that has to happen to make the fragrance come out, and phthalates are involved. So maybe fragrance-free, a slightly better idea.
Definitely. Or if made from completely, you know, naturally derived fragrances, not synthetic, that would be a recommendation. You can make a lot of your own soaps and home cleaning products as well. And I know that when it comes to, you know, phthalates, there are really serious consequences to exposure. A recent study showed that women exposed may have experienced preterm birth if they have high levels of those in their bodies. And there are many other endocrine disrupting effects they have. But that, you know, these are significant, serious issues, not something to take lightly. So, you know, to protect ourselves, I think we really should think about, you know, making these efforts, these small efforts. They add up.
Yeah, no, I'm going to definitely contact Dr. Bronner's and make sure that their soap doesn't have phthalates in it. But meanwhile, I mean, I feel like Dr. Bronner, if you can't trust Dr. Bronner, who can you trust? You can trust Erica, you can trust Erica Serino, communications manager of the Plastic Pollution Coalition, author of Thicker Than Water, The Quest for Solutions to the Plastic Crisis. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
And we're going to talk about the mass media. You know, Homer Simpson, when he prays to God, he asks God to bring back plastic straws. That can't be good. There are people who look at this stuff, how often non-reusable plastics are depicted in the television shows you watch.
All episodes of The Colin McEnroe Show are available 24/7 at ctpublic.org/Colin, which is also where you can sign up for our delightful free fortnightly newsletter, The Newsletter. You can listen to any episode on any podcast app. Have a question or comment? Email us at colinshow@ctpublic.org. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Sabrina, and thanks to Kat Pastor, our technical producer today. Lily Tyson is the senior producer of The Colin McEnroe Show and is the producer of this episode. Oh, I have to just quickly do a self-plug. For 7 years, I was a regular panelist on The Wheelhouse, and then I stopped being a panelist on The Wheelhouse. But my counselors at Betty Ford have cleared me to go back, so this week I will be appearing on The Wheelhouse with Frankie Graziano to talk about third-party candidates. All right, so we're going to talk now about the television you watch. And you probably don't think too much if you're watching Law and Order about, you know, whether Jerry Orbach had a plastic water bottle in his hand. But somebody is thinking about that. And that somebody is represented today by Dana Weinstein, project specialist for the Media Impact Project at the University of Southern California, Annenberg Norman Lear Center. So Dana, first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so tell us about this report. It's called Flip the Script, How Can Hollywood Help Us Imagine a Future Without Plastic? A Content Analysis of Single-Use Plastics in Scripted TV. So you watched a lot of TV shows. What did you find?
Yeah. Back in 2021, we partnered with the Plastic Pollution Coalition to basically study how often reusable items and also single-use plastics appeared in these popular scripted shows. A main finding that really stuck with me from the research, kind of like Erica said, plastic is all around us at all times. And, you know, maybe this isn't a huge surprise, but we found this to be the case on TV too. So we saw that single-use plastics are pretty commonplace on TV, but their disposal is often rendered invisible. So we found that characters interacted with an average of 28 single-use plastic items per episode. And then in addition to that, there was an average of one mass plastic event, which was basically a mass plastic event was defined as a scene with 10 or more plastic items in the background. So that could be a scene and set in a grocery store, a coffee shop, or even when a character opens up their fridge, for example.
Yeah, and if characters are having a birthday party or an office party, there's probably going to be a whole bunch of red Solo cups all over the place and not much thought given to that. What is there a kind of an underlying theory, an underpinning theory about what that does? I mean, I guess it makes us more casual, more accepting of the idea that people are just going to use this stuff and less worried about where it goes.
Yeah, exactly. So, like I said, you know, we saw that a lot of plastic items were present on TV, but the kind of interesting thing was that we observed that their disposal was often rendered invisible. So basically, you know, we tracked what happened to each single use item over the course of the episode. So, you know, whether it was thrown away, recycled, littered, etc. And what we found was that 93% of items were not disposed of on screen. What our friends at the Plastic Pollution Coalition really helped us understand is that this invisibility of disposal feeds into a false narrative of what they call magically disappearing trash, which is basically the idea that plastic items just go away on their own, without really acknowledging their harm on people and the planet, or, you know, really the burden that goes into managing all the waste that we collectively produce.
There's also, I mean, it may make sense or it may not make sense to differentiate between drama and comedy. I was mentioning heading into this segment that, and this is really true, that at least on one episode of The Simpsons, Homer is down on his knees saying his nightly prayers and he asks for the return of plastic straws and he says the paper ones get way too soggy. That's what he's asking God for. So I don't know, it could be argued that Homer Simpson's an idiot. And so this is an idiotic position or thing to be taking. But one of the things that you found was that wanton disposal of non-reusable items, otherwise known as littering, was sometimes done to get a laugh. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, like I said, in general, we didn't see a whole lot of items being disposed. But when we did look specifically at episodes depicting disposal, it was about 20% of episodes used littering for comedic effect. So, you know, like the example that you're describing. Another one that we highlighted in the report was there was an episode of Superstore, which aired on NBC at the time. And it showed, you know, like a disgruntled employee littering a plastic drink cup in kind of this comedic fit of rage to protest the store's new cleaning robot. And so, you know, obviously a lot of this is based in the idea of behavior modeling, right? Which is the idea that, you know, people tend to model or imitate the behaviors that they see modeled by others, and that even extends to fictional characters that the audiences come to identify with over time. And so, you know, of course, littering isn't a desirable behavior to model on TV, but, you know, given the absence or invisibility of disposal in general, you know, if you paired that depiction with some type of critical dialogue, you know, it could kind of serve to make the issue of plastic pollution more visible.
I think this is a whole area that's very interesting, too. In addition to everything that we've said so far, there's that kind of whole idea of parasocial relationships, these relationships we have with people we don't really know. I don't know Jack Bauer. I don't know what he does with his water bottle after he gets through drinking it. He probably throws it away and goes and shoots somebody. But we do form these bonds with these fictional characters and with the stars who play these fictional characters. And I'm assuming that there is probably a subliminal possibility that we're going to adopt some of their behaviors.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've highlighted some of kind of the more wasteful examples of plastic on TV, but, you know, there were kind of notable or positive examples of characters modeling reusable behaviors on screen. So, you know, again, to use the show Superstore as an example, an example that we talk about in the report is how they repeatedly showed major characters from that show drinking from these reusable Hydro Flask coffee cups in their break room, set in the fictional universe of the show, right? And so we were pretty excited by the fact that these were recurring characters using these items. And like you said, that's kind of in light of the research on parasocial relationships, which is essentially when people develop a relationship with a fictional character or even an actor. And then these parasocial bonds that are formed can really serve as a powerful socializing force to encourage positive behaviors, right? So the hope is that someone sees their favorite character on Superstore using a reusable coffee cup, and then they're, you know, inspired to bring their own mug to work in real life.
I mean, the other part of this is, you know, there's a high probability if you're watching a television show or a movie where people are drinking a lot of Poland Spring plastic water bottles, that's probably also when the cameras get turned off and they run over to take their break. The likelihood that they're using some kind of reusable mug with tap water in it, I think it goes down a little bit. If that's what you're seeing on the screen, it's probably what's happening off screen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting way to think about it because the impact is twofold, right? So when you swap out a reusable item, or sorry, if you swap out a plastic item for a reusable item, it's like an impact on screen, right? You're encouraging positive behavior modeling, but it's also like an impact in real life in the sense that you're actually kind of greening the TV set itself behind the scenes.
First of all, we should say that occasionally I think there are depictions that are mostly I'm thinking about movies here. There's that plastic bag in American Beauty, which is kind of dancing around in the breeze. And it's both, I think, a symbol of how something horrible and trashy can temporarily look beautiful as it's moving around. But I don't think it necessarily invites a lot of cogitation about it. I don't know. Have you gotten any sense from the industry? We don't have too much time left to talk about this, whether the study that you did or anything else broke through a little bit and maybe wanted them to be a little bit more conscious about this stuff?
Yeah. So I work on the research arm of the center, but we do have an outreach arm of the center called Hollywood Health and Society that works directly with the entertainment industry to kind of educate and inform on these issues. So I know they've taken this report and its findings directly into writers' rooms and even production companies to kind of help educate about plastic pollution and really how the entertainment industry can help. You know, I can't say for sure whether things are getting better or worse without a follow-up study, but but anecdotally, my sense is that we're starting to see some interest and movement on the issue in Hollywood, just based on what I've heard from our partners.
All right, we have to stop there. Dana Weinstein, project specialist for the Media Impact Project at the University of Southern California, Annenberg, Norman Lear Center. Thank you very much. Thanks to everybody else. We gotta go.
Think I forgot how to be happy. Something I'm not, but something I can be. Something I wait for. Something I'm made for.